You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Good evening. Let's begin by setting our motivation. So let's reflect on the circumstances that we have right here in this very moment. For the next hour, we'll have the opportunity to review the teachings that we've received on Nagarjuna's precious garland. We're safe. We have enough to eat. And we have lodgings that are very comfortable and warm. Around the world, so many people and other living beings are bereft of some, if not all of these things. In addition, so many people are dealing with the shock and grief of suddenly losing their loved ones, either due to illness, accidents, or gun violence. So doing what we're doing tonight is virtually impossible for them. So it may be obvious, but sometimes we don't reach this conclusion, but to repay the kindness of our teachers and their teachers and all the people over time who have worked so hard to preserve the teachings in a pure form, let's do our very best to take these teachings to heart, to transform our mind and be of benefit as much as we are able to now, and to keep the long-term goal of full awakening alive in our heart and mind. So if you're tuning in for the first time tonight, you're probably thinking to yourself, that's not Venerable Children. You're absolutely right, it's not Venerable Children. She is in Singapore right now with Venerable Dumcho and Venerable Senke, spreading the Dharma. And if you're in that part of the world, please look on our website to find out where and what time she's teaching there for the next 2 weeks. And for those of us who are here tonight, we're going to start reviewing the teachings that we've been receiving since actually April 30th of this year. And so I think there's 22 questions on the list that was sent out if you received it. And don't worry, we're not going to do all 22 tonight. We're going to do the first 7. And then next week we'll be doing questions 8 through, I don't know what it is. Anyway, we'll divide it up 8 through 15, and the following week 16 through 19. So it's a great opportunity to go through these magnificent teachings again and again, and we were reminded just this past week by Jeffrey Hopkins that repetition is just so important. And sadly, I haven't done the 2,000 repetitions that he suggested, so I'm tied to a script tonight. And maybe in a few years I could sit here without a script, but that's not going to be the case for a long, long time. So I thought we could go through these questions, and maybe we can try this format where I'll start off, and if I'm going in a wildly wrong direction, everyone in the room can start waving your hands. And then, because I won't have all of the information for each of these questions, or you've got it in a different way that's beneficial, I think it's really important to hear it from different angles. Then, you know, please, everybody here, I'm talking to you, please come up and you can also contribute what you have in response to the questions. Okay? Okay! So, we're going to be discussing Nagarjuna's precious garland. And Venerable Children has been teaching from a commentary has been given by Kenshi Jampa Taekchok, which is very beautiful. And just a little bit about Nagarjuna. He lived in South India, and There's some debate as to when he lived and how long he lived. Some say he was born and died between 50 and 150 CE, and other people say he was born in 150 and he lived to 250 CE, and some Tibetans say he lived to be 600 years. Some people say there are many Nagarjunas. I don't know if that part of it is so important, but what he has written and has come to us through him and other people who have passed this down is absolutely magnificent. And so as we've been learning these past months, what are the two themes of Precious Garland? What are they addressing?
Fortunate rebirth and greater good.
Highest good. Right. Upper rebirth and highest good. So we'll be hearing a lot about that and how we achieve that in the next several weeks. So I think we'll just launch in with the questions. And the first question is, why is Nagarjuna specifically teaching a king? Do you think that the advice he gives the king would be different from advice he would give you personally? So I think if I first heard about this and I was just new to the Dharma, I could get really grumpy right off the bat and think, there you go. A king gets these teachings, one on one, from Nagarjuna. I knew it all along. It's the powerful and the famous and the rich who get to have these kinds of privileges, and you can see how that mind would, you know, go down a very grumpy road. But that would be totally missing the point of this. And I thought I'd share with something that Jeffrey Hopkins has written actually in his writings about this text, which actually gives quite an interesting different tone than what we're hearing from Khenchur Jampa Tekcho. So I'll start with Jeffrey and then we'll move to Khenchur Jampa Tekcho. So Jeffrey says this. It is said that he wrote the Precious Garland specifically for a Shatavana king, and this is going to be described in a few minutes. He describes the advice as sometimes being unpleasant, comparing it to distasteful but effective medicine. Monarchs who do what is against the practices and senseless are mostly praised by their citizens. For it is hard to know what will or will not be tolerated. Hence, it is hard to know what is useful or not to say. If useful but unpleasant words are hard to speak to anyone else, what could I, a monk, say to you, a king, who is a lord of the great earth? So there's a footnote as to this Shatavana king, and one of these scholars says that he identifies the king as presumably Gautamiputra, the lord over the three oceans, as recorded in Nasik edict of his mother Balari, stated to be a friend of Nagarjuna, as the person to whom two of the friendly epistles were addressed. Robert Thurman identifies the king as Udayi in Nagarjuna's Guidelines for Buddhist Social Action. So it's not quite known for sure who this king was. There's a number of opinions. And then Jeffrey continues, but because of my affection for you, this is Nagarjuna speaking to the king, and from compassion for all beings, I tell you without hesitation, that which is useful but unpleasant. When Nagarjuna says that his motivation is not just affection for the king, but also compassion for all beings, he intends to benefit others from reading and contemplating his advice. For at the end of the poem, he announces that these teachings are also for others. These doctrines were not just taught only for monarchs, but were taught with a wish to help other sentient beings as befits them. He extends the attitude of implementing unpleasant but salutary advice to encompass practice in general, in that the attainment of a greater end makes temporary difficulties bearable. Even if in ordinary life pain can bring future benefit, what need is there to say that accepting suffering, beneficial for one's own and others' happiness, will help? This practice is known as the policy of the ancients. If through relinquishing small pleasures, there is extensive happiness later. Seeing the greater happiness, the resolute should relinquish small pleasures now. If such things cannot be borne, then doctors giving distasteful medicines would disappear. if it is not reasonable to forsake great pleasures for the small. Sometimes what is thought harmful is regarded as helpful by the wise. General rules and their exceptions are commanded in all treatises. At other points, however, the advice is described as being gentle and soothing. The supramundane Victor said that students are to be told the truth in a gentle, meaningful, and salutary way. They should be told at the proper time and from compassion. So that is why you are being told all of this. O steadfast one, when true words are spoken without belligerence, they should be taken as fit to be heard, like water fit for bathing. And then we'll go back to Geshe Jempa Tegchok's version of this. Nagarjuna says to the king, I'm going to teach you so you can practice this and attain the results, because the Dharma results can be attained when the Dharma is explained to someone who is receptive. Nagarjuna's particular reason for explaining the Dharma to the king is to establish these practices in a vessel of the excellent doctrine. In other words, in someone who is receptive, who can hold these teachings, meaning to put these teachings into practice and teach them to others. When the Dharma is explained to someone who is a suitable vessel, that person will practice the Dharma and gain all the magnificent results, and then will spread that Dharma to others who will also gain. And so now we get to go back and review what makes someone a suitable vessel. So here the king is a suitable vessel, and this is discussed in the Lamrim, and we also heard about it, I think, 2 weeks ago? And we heard about it in Aryadeva's 400 verses. So what are the three qualities of a suitable vessel?
They're advised, open-minded.
So I'll review those and I'll just add them. All right, so suitable vessel. This is what we want to be. This is why the king got the teachings. So if we can do this, you know, eventually we'll be able to do what the king was able to hear. So a suitable vessel, unbiased and open-minded. That means we're able to take in new information without preconceptions and opinions getting in the way. So how do we do that? Well, Venerable Children says, first of all, we have to recognize and turn off the opinion factory. That's hard to do. That means telling ourselves to listen to other living beings and to subdue our pride and to realize, hey, other people have good ideas and it's good for me to learn from them. So that's the first quality. The second quality is being intelligent and that we can discern what's correct and incorrect. So we have to determine what kind of teachings make sense and what is hogwash. And we have to have some willingness to think about the teachings. And then the third quality of a suitable vessel is that we're eager and interested in the Dharma. And this means we seek out teachings. And we seek out those who practice them enthusiastically. So I guess when we think about this one, we can ask ourselves, to what extent do I have these three qualities? And you know, I think on given days, we have all three. And on other days, I'll just speak for myself. I have one, maybe two, maybe none. And there it goes. So I think the critical thing is that we really keep these qualities in mind and really do our best to make ourselves into suitable vessels so that, you know, we have this opportunity to hear the Dharma from Venerable Children and her teachers, and to do what we can to be suitable vessels. So the king happens to be a suitable trainee. And in this case, when a king is a suitable trainee, then great benefit will happen. And in the case of Nagarjuna and the king, there was benefit happening to Nagarjuna for explaining these teachings and to the king from hearing it. So when you hear the teachings, that also means learning, reading, studying. And that is the best wealth you can have, Venerable Children says, because with that, no one can take away the teachings from you. Hearing the teachings is like a lamp that illuminates the darkness. It's showing us why we're miserable and the way to transform our mind to get out of our misery. Hearing the teachings is our best friend because it never leaves us. It's the best path because it leads us to the highest good and full awakening. So Nagarjuna is going to give the king instructions on how to attain an upper rebirth and the highest good. And he's not just going to teach him theory, but he's also going to teach him practical things, like how to treat your citizens. And if we're Dharma practitioners, or if he is a Dharma practitioner or she, here's how you govern the country. Here's how you help the monasteries. Here's how to offer respect to people worthy of respect. And how to serve the three jewels. And this is why we should follow these instructions. And so he gives all of this to the king, so that the king can apply these things and affect everyone in his kingdom. Later on, Nagarjuna tells the king things like, don't have fare on taxation and have rest spots for travelers who are going through your country. Make sure people are paid adequately and try and resolve conflicts before going to war. Make prisons pleasant so that people can be rehabilitated and don't put them in prison for their whole life. So can you imagine what it would be like if any leader of a country right now had this opportunity to hear these teachings? And, you know, just how magnificent it would be. So if there's time tonight at the end of this review, I really want to write a letter to the new Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau. And Justin Trudeau introduced, or he did something with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Toronto. Did you go to those teachings in Toronto?
2004.
Yeah. Well, at some point, Justin Trudeau met His Holiness. And so I think this is a perfect opening. I don't know if my letter will ever get to Justin Trudeau, but, you know, I think it's worth a try. So you can help me compose a draft tonight of what we can say to Justin Trudeau and why he should listen to the teachings of Precious Garland. I'll stick with Canadian politics. I don't really understand American politics. So. Okay, so that was a long answer to the first question. Does anyone else want to come up and say it in your way? Anything to add? Not at this point. Okay, let's keep going.
Except that.
Yes.
And I don't need to come up for that. But the verse where he says, it's because of my affection for you. Mm. I mean, it makes it also very clear that the king has a respect for him. Mm. And that there's a relationship there that also is part of what makes him receptive. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Right? Good point.
The king has enough humility to listen to a great monk.
Mm. Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
The other piece of the question was, do we think that the advice he gives the king would be different from the advice he would give us personally? And I don't think it would be different.
No. Question two, why does the author at the beginning of a treatise pay homage to the three jewels? Okay, you're first.
Express humility.
Express humility.
It's part of the tradition.
It's part of the tradition.
The three jewels is what, following the three jewels and paying homage to them and understanding what that means is what will lead everybody to liberation and higher rebirth.
Sets the stage for the source of the teaching, too.
Yeah.
Sets the stage for the source of the teaching. So at the beginning, Nagarjuna pays homage to the three jewels to make his mind humble and a way for the author to remember that he's explaining the words of the Buddha. Yeah. He's not making something up outside of what the Buddha taught. The purpose of paying homage to the Buddha is to fulfill our own and others' aims. So I just want to do a check right now because people are saying very valuable things in the room. Are they coming through to the people online?
Yes, they're hearing.
Okay, great. Great. Okay, so with the third question, we're going to start with the people online. So the third question is, describe the excellent abandonment and excellent realization of the Buddha. I guess that's kind of unfair because people would have to type very fast. Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll start, and then if I miss things, then the people online can help us out. Okay? All right, first of all, perfect abandonment. A Buddha has abandoned everything to be abandoned, all the defilements, all the self-centeredness, all the subtle stains. The mind is completely free. Wouldn't that be magnificent? Huh. So in the first verse, free, that's indicated by the line that says, utterly free of all faults. That indicates the excellent abandonment that is one's own aim, or the truth body, and the Buddha, has also fulfilled his own aim of gaining all the excellent realizations. So Nagarjuna praises the Buddha because he's totally omniscient and knows all objects to be known, and he's endowed with all good qualities. So he has attained the truth body. The truth body adorned with 10 powers, 4 fearlessnesses, and 18 unshared qualities. And these 10 powers, the 4 fearlessnesses, and 18 unshared qualities are found both in the Pali and the Sanskrit traditions. And I'm not going to take time to talk about those tonight, because the Venerable Children taught on those before. And also, you can read about those on starting on page 20 in Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. His truth body, the Buddha's mind, is beautified with the wisdom that directly understands the 4 truths of the Aryas and perceives all phenomena that are to be known. And he perceives all phenomena that are to be known with direct, unmistaken wisdom. And then at one point, Venerable Chodron made the comment that some people say that the Buddha is not omniscient, but that he's all-knowing, meaning that if he turns his mind to anything, he will know it. But in each moment of consciousness, he doesn't know everything. It only happens when he turns his mind to a certain object. However, in the universe of Ayoka, we say the Buddha all the time, the nature of the mind is clarity and awareness. It's only obstacles and obscurations. It's only obstacles or obscurations that are the things that impede the mind from perceiving things. And since a Buddha has eliminated all those obscurations, then naturally, all phenomena that exist appear to the Buddha without any hindrance, and he knows all phenomena at the same time. Anyone have anything else to add to this? Okay. Question 4. Why do we learn... Venerable Trini has something.
No, it's a question. We did all the abandonments, but did we do all the realizations?
Kind of the part about the 10 powers. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that was...
All
the excellent realizations.
Okay.
Yeah, all those.
Yeah, but thanks for asking.
Yeah. One thing with the about the omniscience is that the Buddha can see emptiness, conventionalities at the same time, which is quite remarkable and beyond our hearts.
Yes. Okay. Question 4. Why do we learn and practice for higher rebirth? Before practicing to attain the highest good, when attaining the highest good is our final goal. The 2 factors of upper rebirth and highest good, as Khenchur Jampa Tegchok and Nagarjuna say, must be practiced in order. So first we have to learn the 16 causal factors to attain an upper rebirth. And those are... We got to do this last week.
It starts off with the
10 non-virtues. Not taking intoxicants. Proper livelihood.
Yeah. We don't start off with the 10 non-virtues.
Well,
avoiding the 10 non-virtues. 3 things to abandon.
And 3 things to practice.
Yeah, okay. So 13 things to abandon. The 10 non-virtues, avoiding intoxicants, abandoning harm,
maintaining
proper livelihood, and then the 3 virtuous ones.
Generosity.
Paying reference to those who are
honoring those worthy of honor. Yes, okay. So that's where we have to start, those 16. And after practicing those well and being able to gain a series of upper rebirths, then we receive explanation on the final aim of the path, the wisdom realizing emptiness. And we practice that and meditate on that in order to attain the highest good. And it's very important that these things come in order. And then Venerable Chogyam went on to explain that further. So Nagarjuna is saying, you have to be practical. We have to be practical. And it's going to take more than one lifetime to become a fully awakened Buddha. So we better make sure that we have a good rebirth so that we can continue practicing in our next life. And then in the life after that, and the lives after that. So we've got to create enough virtue so that we have another good rebirth. And in all of our lives, to continually create a lot of virtue for good rebirths. We need to create the causes for good rebirths, which are to keep good ethical conduct. So we have an upper rebirth. And then we have to practice the six perfections so that we can have good cooperative conditions in that upper rebirth. And then it's really important that we make sincere and stainless prayers for that to come about. And then if we dedicate the merit for full awakening as a byproduct, we'll get an upper rebirth. To create the cause to receive an upper rebirth, that's the platform on which we stand to get liberation and awakening. And then Nagarjuna goes on emphasizing that we have to go in this order for the teachings. And so we start off with teachings on easier topics like precious human life, impermanence, death, refuge, and karma. And those, as we know, are not really easy. And then we receive teachings on more in-depth teachings like the Four Truths of the Noble Ones, so that we can really see what the causes of samsara are and what the path out of samsara is. And then we go on and we learn about bodhicitta and then emptiness. So there is this kind of order in which we learn the topics, and that's the Lam Rim order. And then Venerable Chogyam went on to say that when you're learning them, and to learn them in this order, when you're practicing, you can practice everything. You can practice all of the topics in the Lam Rim, but we need to emphasize the point where we're at. So at the beginning, we learn all of these teachings, but what we're going to emphasize is precious human life, death and impermanence, refuge and karma, so that we can attain a good rebirth in the future. When we learn them in order, we can practice them in the whole big picture, but we emphasize where we're at. It's helpful to have an understanding of the entire path and to do a glance meditation every day, but to practice to emphasize where we are at this time. And Venerable Chogyam went on to say that if we are practicing Tantra, and if we don't have all the qualifications to fulfill our commitments, she said it's still good to practice Tantra, but and to do it in a way that plants good seeds in our mind. And then we've got to remember to do the preliminaries to get rid of all the negative karma that will prevent us from gaining realizations. And then continue meditating on precious human life and impermanence so that we can create the causes for good rebirths. So it's really important to know what to emphasize in our practice so we don't get confused. And at this point, I thought it was really good for us to review Nagarjuna's purpose in writing The Precious Garland. So the subject matter is upper rebirth and the highest good. On the basis of a good rebirth, then we can create causes to attain the highest good together with their causes and effects. Not just what they are, but what causes them and what the effects of having them are. So the immediate purpose in writing this treatise was to help himself and others understand the causes of upper rebirth and the highest good. We have to understand what the causes are before we can create them. Then Nagarjuna's essential purpose in writing this treatise, the long-term goal, is by studying and understanding upper rebirth and highest good, and the methods to gain both of these, then the essential purpose is to engage in the practice of creating those causes. And in that way, we'll attain an upper rebirth, which is a stepping stone to attaining the highest good, which is the essential purpose of why he's teaching this, so that sentient beings can attain liberation, and more particularly, full awakening. And then the connection is the relationship between these three. So the attainment of liberation and awakening, which is the essential purpose. That's connected to the second point, the immediate purpose, which is learning the causes of those two. And that immediate purpose is connected to the subject matter, which is upper rebirth and highest good, and their causes and effects. So having said all that, Nagarjuna's ultimate purpose is to help us attain full awakening, and the immediate one is to keep us out of the lower realms. And to do either of those, then we have to learn what upper rebirth and highest good and their causes and effects are. Does anyone have anything to add to question four? Okay. All right, I'm going to let everyone in the room have first crack at the next question, which reads, in what order are higher rebirth and the highest good ascertained, first of all? And then which is ascertained first? That rebirth as a human or God is a higher rebirth, or that liberation and full awareness are the highest good? And which of the two is attained first? So who'd like to go and give this one a try?
I'll just say it in my own words.
Okay.
In terms of attaining things, you attain a higher rebirth before you would attain the final goal, in terms of attaining.
Yes.
Because you need a bunch of higher rebirths to get to the final goal.
Yes.
But in terms of ascertaining, it's the reverse, because it's because of the types of phenomena that manifest, unmanifest, and all, or the hidden and slightly hidden and all that. All the things that it takes to make a higher rebirth are extremely hidden phenomena. So, whereas the things to get liberation are only slightly hidden, you can understand those by logic. So, that means to ascertain, you'd have to be a Buddha to actually ascertain the details of getting a higher rebirth.
Right.
Heather wrote, when we first attain higher rebirth and then highest good, but in terms of ascertaining then, we must first realize highest good before we can fully realize higher rebirth. This is because higher rebirth is dependent on the realization of karma, which is a very obscure phenomena and can only be known by the omniscient mind or expert testimony. Ascertaining the highest good, a slightly obscure phenomena, on the other hand, can be known by reasoning and thus is ascertained.
I had a question about this thing about the karma actually only being ascertained by a Buddha, which I remember in the teachings, and I just saw in my notes, and I've always held. But then recalling what we just learned about the acquisition or the development of the super knowledges, and how arhats begin to have this understanding of karma, or being able to see the rebirths of others before they're Buddhas. So it made me wonder, maybe only a Buddha can see the whole, every single solitary detail thing. Mm. But it seems as you progress, especially along the bodhisattva paths, that you have increasing capacity to ascertain that.
Right. And it's only the Buddha.
Path, actually. You don't even have to be a bodhisattva. Those things come with clairvoyance, and all those things come with meditative abilities, so you could be a non-Buddhist, which is what they talk about in some of the other texts, like where people got mixed up is they couldn't see enough rebirths out. So they remember some of the non-Buddhists,
yep.
They only could see so far, mm-hmm. So they could see some result, causes and results, but they couldn't see far enough out. So they thought that there wasn't actually
But aren't the last three, those, what do they call them, not the super knowledge is, but the... I'll have to look. I'll have to look it up.
Heather wrote, I asked Venerable about this once, and it's a progression.
Yes.
Only Buddha can see the entire picture.
Yeah.
Right.
But as we get closer, we increasingly have that ability.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. To go check.
And then Geshe Chamba Tekchok added more about this. To understand liberation and enlightenment means you have to gain the cause, which is emptiness, which is a slightly obscure phenomenon, as we just discussed, which is understood by the power of the fact, the inference of the power of the fact, or by reasoning. To understand that someone is an upper rebirth or has an upper rebirth, you have to understand karma, which is very obscure. And the only way we can really understand it is through the Buddha's wisdom and scriptural authority in which he teaches us those things. That is why, in terms of ascertaining them, we can ascertain liberation and emptiness before we can ascertain somebody being an upper rebirth or having an upper rebirth. So he made the point when Khenpo Jampa Tegchog would go to the marketplace, someone can ascertain him but can't ascertain someone with an upper rebirth. As a human being, I am technically an upper rebirth, but if you realize me, you do not necessarily realize upper rebirth. When I go to town, many people realize me with valid cognition, but they don't realize that I'm an upper rebirth because that takes a lot of thought. Not to mention other things. So, and as Venerable Tarpa started off by saying, the order of attainment is the other way around. First, we practice the causes for upper rebirth and attain upper rebirth. Then, on the basis of an upper rebirth, we practice the causes of highest good and attain the highest good. To realize upper rebirth, it's not enough to realize something that is. It is not enough to realize something that is upper rebirth. We must understand it is an upper rebirth from the viewpoint of its causes. Okay, question 6. What are the roles of wisdom and faith in attaining higher rebirth and highest good? Which one is foremost? Which one comes first? And why?
Faith is first. Wisdom is foremost.
Faith is first, wisdom is foremost. Yes, so the causes of upper rebirth and highest good are faith and wisdom. And so in verse 5, it says, because one has faith, one partakes of the Dharma. Because one has wisdom, one truly understands. Of these two, wisdom is the foremost, but faith must come first. So faith refers to confidence or belief in the law of karma and its effects, as well as the four truths, the three jewels, and so forth. Having faith in the basic Buddhist worldview and objects of refuge. Faith in the three jewels and the law of karma and its effects is the cause for ethical conduct, which is the cause for upper rebirth. Having an upper rebirth is the basis for generating the wisdom realizing emptiness, which in turn is the direct cause for the highest good of liberation and awakening. Without the foundation of upper rebirth, there is absolutely no way to develop the correct understanding of emptiness. So faith in karma and its effects means we have some understanding of the four principal aspects of karma. So let's go through those. We've done this a lot, but I think it's good to go through them again. So what are the four principal aspects of karma? Happiness
karma
comes
is
from...
definite in that happiness results from virtuous actions. Misery results from non-virtuous actions.
Yes. Happiness comes from virtue. Suffering comes from non-virtue. The second principal aspect of karma, a small...
Karma is expanding.
Can bring a big result. The third one, if you don't...
Create the cause.
And if you do create the cause,
you get the result.
This is a very hard one for me to get. And the fourth one, our actions will definitely bring effects unless
they are
mitigated. Purified or destroyed.
Yeah.
Right. So if we don't do purification, the karma will not get lost. Anger and wrong views prevent virtuous karma from ripening. Knowing this can be a big help to calm down our anger, because we don't want to waste our virtue by getting angry. So, to review these points, of the two causes, faith and wisdom, wisdom realizing emptiness is the principal one cause that will free us from dukkha. However, before we can generate that wisdom, this is going to take many lifetimes, because we have not done the work in previous lifetimes. So although wisdom is the principal one leading to liberation, to generate that wisdom, we need a series of upper rebirths. And to get that series of upper rebirths, then we have to create the karma to do that. To create the karma, we need to have faith in the law of karma and its effects. So that's why in the verse it says, of these two, wisdom is the foremost. But faith must come first, because we really have to practice. We have to understand karma. We have to understand the law of karma. And due to having faith in that, then we'll have that series of upper rebirths and we'll behave in a way that brings that about. Faith in karma and its effects is a good start, but it alone is not going to get us to awakening. And that wisdom realizing emptiness is what we want, but we have to create the cause to get it. So to do that, we have to create a lot of virtue so that we have a good rebirth, and so that our mind stream is buoyed by that virtue. And then when our mind stream is enriched by virtue, it becomes much easier to generate wisdom. And as Venerable Children made the comment, when our mind doesn't have much virtue in it, then it's like a dry desert, and not so much can grow in it. So the Lama Rim gives us many reasons why faith is fundamental. It is crucial for generating wisdom and good qualities. Through having faith and belief in the points of the instructions, we'll be motivated to practice the correct path according to them without being distracted by many useless doubts. So it's quite interesting that there's such an emphasis on faith, but this isn't blind faith. This is really reasoned faith. And that the two of them are essential, faith and wisdom. We're going along much more quickly than I thought we would. So, question 7. What are the three types of phenomena? We've already actually touched on this. And the three types of reliable cognizers that know them.
Manifest phenomena. Or obvious phenomena. Evident.
Evident, manifest phenomena.
Slightly obscured
phenomena.
Slightly hidden. Very obscured.
Very obscure.
Very extremely, I believe, sometimes.
Extremely. So with evident phenomena, like seeing the table, hearing the sound of the bell, these are realized by
sense consciousness.
Right.
Direct perception.
Right.
Directly perceiving sense.
And what realizes slightly obscure phenomena?
Inference.
Reasoning, inference by power of the fact, and the obscure, very obscure.
Relying on authoritative scriptures.
Authoritative scriptures.
What is it called? Inference by power. It's also an inference.
for extremely?
No.
That's...
It's not an inference by scriptural authority?
Inference by power of the fact is...
Yeah, I think they have the name of that. But is that what it was called? I don't know. I can't remember that for years.
We'll have to check on that.
I think right, there were four kinds of inference.
Yeah, it's an inference of the scriptural.
Inference by scriptural authority.
Mm, okay.
Or by direct mental perception, if you're
fully if you're a Buddha. Yeah.
Four types of inference. We studied that.
So we'll have to do some checking on that. Geshe Jampa Tekchok says this about these. Just to give us a bit more. The impermanence of sound can't be known by the auditory consciousness of ordinary beings. We must first understand it by applying reasoning, such as the syllogism, sound is impermanent because it is a product of causes. Like impermanence, emptiness is also a slightly obscure phenomenon. Thus, we must initially use reasoning to understand it. We can't just sit still, close our eyes, and expect the emptiness of inherent existence to appear to our minds. This is especially true because inherent existence appears to all consciousnesses of sentient beings, except to an Arya's meditative equipoise and emptiness. Because all of our conventional consciousnesses are contaminated in this way, the only way to initially realize emptiness is by reasoning. And then he goes on to say this about very obscure, extremely hidden phenomena. They are those that we know by depending on the word of a reliable expert on the topic, rely on authoritative testimony. For example, to know our birth date, we rely on our parents. Similarly, to understand the minute details of the functioning of karma and its effects, we rely on the Buddha and his explanations. So, that's the seven questions. And we have 9 more minutes. Venerable Trini, you've got an idea.
Well, you know, how do we generate faith in karmana and its effects actually follows quite, you know, quite on the heels of that, where we were. So maybe that's worth just a discussion for a few minutes. We can go on to the next question.
What if you lead it?
Okay, what do you think?
Here you go.
Just generally, how do we generate faith in karma and its effects?
Well, sometimes in just this life, we can do something and then experience a very clear result from it, you know? And so that, just from our experience, I think, gives credence. We can gain some confidence.
Yeah.
And in the days when we're prone to lying, we start off with a small lie. And then we have to remember what that small lie is, and we keep perpetuating the lie, and we embellish it, and pretty soon we don't know who we've told what. And then if this keeps on as a habitual pattern, people just don't believe us. And so we've, I'm sure, experienced that in varying degrees.
How about, since we just answered the question that in order to, that we have to rely on scriptural authority in order to understand this, understand extremely hidden phenomena like karma, how is it that we develop this confidence in the scriptural authority? Like, do we just take it on because the Buddha said it?
That really opens up the whole can of worms of definitive and non-definitive scriptures.
Could.
Some people say, oh, Buddha said this, and some people say that's definitive, some people say that's not. Especially about
the nature of reality itself, but I think, I mean, way before we get into the wisdom teachings, though, there's some pretty straight, especially in the Lam Rim, the outline, you know, we look at reflecting, for example, on death is certain. Time of death is uncertain. Nothing happens, nothing helps the time of death but our practice, or nothing goes with us but our consciousness, like reflecting on those kinds of teachings, or the truth, true suffering, true dukkha, reflecting on true dukkha, we think about that and start to develop faith in the Buddha. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Sort of a progression of understanding various steps of the Buddha's teachings, and then we start to trust the Buddha, the Buddha's word on things.
I was also going to say that we see horrible things happen to people that we perceive as really good people, and so we have to think that there must be a reason for that, and that could be a way that we generate faith in karma.
Yeah.
Thinking about both those questions and just had to share. When I have gone to Airway Heights, I've brought up a couple times that how karma is extremely hidden, and brought up the notion that maybe somebody wouldn't have any belief in it, you know, might have trouble believing in it. And it's been an interesting conversation there, because it's the what I've gotten back, especially from one person, is that never comes up for him. For him, it just makes, it's that part of it that's just common sense. This is what Dasha Rinpoche used to say all the time. There's part of this that's just common sense. Mm-hmm. What goes around comes around. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows that in their own experience. So he couldn't relate at all, and this has come up a few times. So I think there's part of it that when you just think about your own. Same thing for the second question. For me, it comes down to that. Like, so many things that the Buddha has taught have worked, you know. And I've actually decided in my own mind that there's not any mental state. My experience tells me there's no mental state I've ever had in all my years that Buddhism wouldn't help me to work with. Mm-hmm. And so, based on that, I have, and I know my mind is obscured. Based on that, I have faith in things that I don't know that the Buddha said. That's how I work it. And a lot of things that I don't have faith in, that I'm working to have faith in, I just keep going based on the fact, knowing how obscured my mind is. I mean, those things are clear to me.
Yeah.
I don't have any, that's not like, I don't have to have any faith to know that. I know that from practice. Mm-hmm. So it's a reasoned faith.
Yeah.
And I submit, even though the textbook thing is that emptiness is a slightly hidden phenomenon and can be ascertained through reasoning, you got to be pretty sharp for that to click. You know, so that by cultivating or practicing the other teachings that make more sense and cultivating faith in the Buddha's word for that, you then have the foundation to actually begin to even try to apply those reasonings. Because otherwise, it's like, well, you either have to accept it on faith, blind faith, and then it's easily shaken, or you accept it on some kind of reasoned faith that says, oh, the Buddha knows what he's talking about, so I'm going to really apply this and try to get it. But it's not just, oh, emptiness, easily understanding emptiness easily comes through reasoning, right? So it's essential. Or maybe conviction is a better way to say it.
There's two comments online. One says, we can generate faith in karma by reflecting on our experiences in relation to what we've been studying, and by developing faith in the Buddhas, we'll be more open to thinking about karma and then influencing our experiences due to what we did in the past. Plus, children who seem to come into the world with extraordinary talents, far different from their parents. Mm-hmm. Then another comment is, we can have faith in things we don't know, can't see, because there are so many other teachings we do and can see proof of.
I found the thing about the inference,
Okay.
Presentation of Mind and Awareness. It's actually on tupinchodron.org. The root text is there. So they take all the different kind of minds and they divide them and they describe them. So this is inferential cognizers are divided into three. There's inference depending on authoritative testimony, which is also called inference through belief. Then there's inference through renown and inference by the power of the fact. Renown depends on,
everybody knows.
A correct sign of renown is
see physical cause and effect. Mm-hmm. We see that in our lives and throughout the world.
Yeah.
And then we can apply that to mental experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So that can give us a clue that cause and effect would also work in that instance.
And also, I don't know about you, but I started off learning these purification practices, not having a clue and not really thinking they would do anything. And I think in all of our experiences over time, there is clearly change happening, probably not as much as we'd like, but you know, through doing these practices, and we don't know how they work, but you know, our mind changes in a positive direction. Thank you, Venerable Jenny. So lots of food for thought. I think I'll do the draft for Justin Trudeau and I'll leave that for another time. It's sort of not the right timing right now, but we can have hope that leaders of countries maybe at some point will at least engage in studying and learning about the 10 non-virtues and avoiding those. And wouldn't that be an incredible thing if a politician...
Maybe should come to the Paris talks. Do it tonight. Get them all
the
at once.
Talks, yeah. All right. Thank you. Let's dedicate.
Thank you.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forever.